Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Hegseth could have endangered troops by sharing details of an attack in a group chat. We'll hear from the journalist added to that chat, Jeffrey Goldberg, on Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, the West Contra Costa Unified Teacher Strike starts today. I'm Brian Watt.
The FBI arrested a man suspected of placing pipe bombs at Republican and Democratic Party headquarters in Washington. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. It happened just before the January 6th attack on the Capitol. What comes next in the case? Also, American veterans fear those delays in processing asylum claims for Afghans will prove deadly for the allies left behind. It is Thursday, December 4th. It's a big day for musicians. Rapper and producer Jay-Z is 56. Hip-hop and country star Jelly Roll is 41. And singer-songwriter Jin of BTS is 33. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. A man believed to be responsible for placing pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol complex nearly 5 years ago is now in federal custody. A law enforcement source tells NPR's Carrie Johnson there's been a breakthrough in the longstanding mystery.
The FBI has spent years searching for the person who put bombs near the Democratic and Republican committee headquarters hours before the assault on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Now a federal law enforcement source says authorities think they have identified the culprit. A news conference is planned in Washington to share more information about the case. FBI agents conducted 1,000 interviews and reviewed nearly 40,000 video files, but the alleged bomber remained elusive for years despite a $500,000 reward. New leaders at the FBI and the Justice Department intensified their focus on the case this year. Carrie Johnson, NPR News.
As Gaza marks nearly 8 weeks of a fragile ceasefire, Israeli airstrikes continue. NPR's Anas Baba reports that Gaza health officials say 6 people were killed, including 2 children, in the latest airstrike.
In the city of Khan Yunis, an Israeli airstrike hit Najat, which means survival in Arabic. It's a tent camp near a hospital for displaced families, redistributed of homes and safety. The survival camp has turned into a mass grave. In addition to the deaths, dozens other were injured. Many of the tents housed hospital staff and their families. The Israeli military said it targeted the Hamas militant in response to a separate incident in southern Gaza, a gun battle between Hamas and Israeli forces that wounded several Israeli soldiers. It is the latest in many violations since the ceasefire began. Gaza health officials say more than 360 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire was declared in October. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
On Wall Street, stocks are trading lower this morning amid mixed signals on the job market. NPR Scott Horsley has more.
A consulting firm that tracks layoff notices says U.S. employers announced more than 71,000 job cuts last month. That's fewer potential pink slips than announced in October, but more than this time last year. That's according to a tally compiled by the outplacement firm Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. New applications for unemployment benefits, which are often seen as a proxy for layoffs, fell last week. The Thanksgiving holiday may have affected those numbers. As of mid-November, some 1.8 million people were receiving some form of jobless assistance. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Tokyo and Hong Kong, but down in Shanghai and Seoul. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And on Wall Street, the Dow is down 63 points, the NASDAQ down 47. The S&P 500 is down 5 points. For the Dow, that's down 0.1%. NASDAQ is down about 0.2%. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. San Francisco and Santa Clara County are suing the Trump administration over its dramatic changes to federal homelessness funding. KQED's Guy Marzorati has more.
Trump's Department of Housing and Urban Development announced last month that it was shifting funds from permanent housing to shelter. But Santa Clara County Council Tony Lopresti says Congress has already approved millions for Bay Area counties.
The president and this administration are attempting to claim and exercise power that belongs to Congress and Congress alone.
Santa Clara County Supervisor Betty Young says the federal government helps residents pay rent and provides services to people living in affordable housing.
Many of those who have benefited from the county's approach will be pushed back onto the streets.
Federal officials argue that temporary housing and shelter will, quote, encourage self-sufficiency. I'm Guy Marzorati, KQED News.
Oakland's police department is paying millions in salaries and benefits to officers who are out on administrative leave, pending investigation, amid a budget and staffing crisis. Chronicle reporter David Hernandez says OPD is more than 200 officers short of what it needs and has 29 officers on leave, 15 of them for more than a year.
You're already short-staffed, you have some officers who are on leave, and you can't get through their investigations quick enough because you are short-staffed and you don't have enough investigators to handle their cases. And it still begs the question, though, about why the department isn't prioritizing administrative investigations of officers more.
Around 50 recruits are set to graduate from the police academy early next year. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support today comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. And by the sustaining members of KQED. At 7:06, here's Mel with traffic in Pittsburgh.
Highway 4 westbound at Loveridge Road, a stall blocking the left lane. Traffic is stacked up from there. 4 on westbound out to Bay Point, where we have a two-car crash now on the shoulder. Meanwhile, in San Jose, this ongoing problem with northbound 101 completely blocked before Hellier Lane. The only way to get by is through the center divide. Very slow through there. Traffic backed up to Metcalf. In the Sunol grade, 680 southbound after Andrade Road, traffic is slow back to 84 west. A hit-and-run crash in the scene there. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. On KQED News with Brian Watt next hour, the Oakland Police Department has pledged to boost the number of women in its ranks, but the agency has fallen short of that goal. What's driving the trend? More on KQED News. Hear the story at 8:22. Partly cloudy this morning. Some areas of patchy fog around the bay. Otherwise, sunny skies again today. Not as windy. Highs in the low 50s to the mid-60s inland.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. At the start of this week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth faced intense scrutiny over a U.S. attack on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean.
Now, an investigation criticizes a past action, the way that Hegseth shared highly sensitive attack plans for airstrikes against Yemen back in March. That was the attack that Hegseth discussed in a group chat that included the journalist Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. In a few minutes, we'll bring Mr. Goldberg into the chat here. First, what the government investigators said about Hegseth.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie is covering this, and he's with us now. Good morning, Greg, to you.
Hi, Michelle.
So where is this new report coming from?
Yeah, this report comes from the Pentagon's Inspector General, who says Hegseth risked endangering U.S. troops by using the Signal messaging app to share military plans before the first attack in Yemen. Now, NPR has not seen the report, but we've been in touch with people who have, and they've described it on condition of anonymity. The report says Hegseth shared information labeled secret as he described details of the U.S. bombing campaign that was just about to begin against the Houthis in Yemen. This report, which is expected to be released publicly today, says Hegseth violated Pentagon rules by using a personal phone for official business.
And would you remind us, who was Hegseth sharing this information with?
Yeah, he was in contact with essentially all top national security officials, the CIA director, director of national intelligence, the national security advisor, the secretary of state. And as we noted, what none of them knew was that Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, was inadvertently included and was reading the messages as well. Now, he didn't report the contents in real time, but did so days later when that U.S. bombing campaign was well underway in Yemen. all of these senior government officials at work and at home have rooms where they can communicate securely on government systems known as SCIFs, a sensitive compartmented information facility. And this is what all of them should have been using. Instead, they were on Signal, a publicly available app anyone can download. It encrypts messages and is considered quite good, but it can be hacked.
And would you remind us of what Hegseth said in these messages?
Yeah, Hegseth gave the exact times the U.S. military was launching F-18 warplanes, drones, and Tomahawk missiles at Yemen. And then he provided updates on when these weapons would begin to strike inside Yemen. And this was the start of a bombing operation against the Houthis that lasted for weeks, and it ended when Houthi attacks diminished against commercial ships in the Red Sea.
Did the Pentagon's Inspector General speak to Hegseth?
So the report says Hegseth gave a written response but would not sit for an interview. Hegseth provided a few of his Signal messages, but the report relied on screenshots that Jeffrey Goldberg published in The Atlantic. Hegseth also denied that he shared classified information, saying he has the authority to declassify information, which is true. He can do that. But the report did not say whether he took any action to do so before sharing the material.
And before we let you go, what is the White House saying about this?
They're saying that, quote, no classified information was leaked and operational security was not compromised. President Trump stands by Secretary Hegseth.
That is NPR's Greg Meyer. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
And I want to mention NPR CEO Catherine Marr also chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Its subsidiary makes the Signal app.
Jeffrey Goldberg is on the line with us. He is editor-in-chief of The Atlantic and is the journalist added to that Signal group chat detailing attacks in Yemen. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning.
I thought of reaching out to you on Signal this morning, but thought better.
I haven't heard that joke before.
I'm sure you haven't, not at all. Does this finding sound about right to you, that Hegseth shared sensitive information that could have endangered a military operation?
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting that there's still an inspector general in the government who's willing to call out the boss. I thought that was unusual. It's very obvious, and it was obvious to me all along, that this was highly secret information being shared in this chat. There were two problems with the chat. One, that it was happening in a commercial messaging app. And the second was that they didn't know who they had added into the chat, namely me, and, you know, violating basic rules of good digital hygiene. The finding sounds, we haven't seen the full report. I haven't read the full report yet, mm-hmm. but the finding seems basically accurate. This was information that could have endangered the lives of American service people because he was putting out real-time information about upcoming bombing runs. Upcoming is the important point.
Absolutely. Like anything ceases to be classified after an operation, possibly, but before an operation is the most sensitive time. Now, you mentioned the Inspector General. I'll give his name, Stephen A. Stebbins. I've been looking him up. He's been promoted across both the Trump and Biden administrations. He's been around for a while. And we should just remind people that the Trump administration fired a bunch of inspectors general early in the administration, but it appears that there are still some left who are willing to say what they think happened.
Right, exactly. And I do find that unusual. What's not unusual is that the administration is behaving as if this was not a leak of classified information. It is true that the Secretary of Defense has declassification power, but to say that the information that he was sharing is not secret and was not sensitive is absurd.
Well, let's get into the statement that has been made in response. Sean Parnell, Pentagon spokesperson, in responding to this news, calls it, quote, a total vindication, adds case closed. What do you think of that?
I think they think that we're very stupid. We, the citizens of the United States. That's obviously a silly statement. There's no exoneration here. Everyone with a phone understands that, it's a mistake, to be providing information to group chats, even non-sensitive information to group chats, that you don't know the participant. You don't know the names of the participants. But it's doubly absurd. I think you don't have to be an expert in national security to know that if you're putting into a general chat the timing of an upcoming bombing run where American pilots are going to be over hostile territory, if you don't think that that's sensitive and should not be shared in an insecure platform, I don't know what to tell you. They obviously believe that they can kind of bull their way through this and just say, nothing to see here, please move along. But the Inspector General, like most Americans studying this, mm-hmm. said, no, there's obviously a problem here, and you guys need to go fix your problem.
And I guess we'll note that Secretary Hegseth himself has also posted on social media that he sees this as total exoneration. You called for accountability when you were on this program earlier in the year, talking about what had just happened at that point. What would accountability look like other than this report, which lays out what the Inspector General feels happened?
Well, the only thing I would say on that is that if this had been a lower ranking civilians in the government or military officers of lower rank in the Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, if they had shared information that was 1/100th as sensitive as this information over a commercial messaging app, the civilians would be fired. The military officers or enlisted personnel would be court-martialed. There are rules governing the sharing of sensitive, classified, secret information, and those rules are applied to people of lower rank.
It strikes me that you think that whether this material was specifically classified or not is not really relevant. It was clearly sensitive information, bottom line, and something should have happened as a result.
It was obviously classified information when Hegseth and others put it onto Signal. I mean, you cannot fool us into thinking that this was not sensitive classified information. It is the most sensitive information the government possesses.
Jeffrey Goldberg is editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Glad you joined us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned earlier, NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Its subsidiary makes the Signal app.
The Trump administration continues to remove incentives for electric vehicles and cleaner gas cars. The latest plan is to change fuel economy standards. Those are the rules that push automakers to produce cars with better gas mileage. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Fuel economy standards have been on a bit of a roller coaster over the last few presidencies. The Obama White House made them much more strict. Then the first Trump White House rolled them back. The Biden presidency, with its focus on fighting climate change and reducing the use of oil, made them more ambitious again. Not really a surprise what happened yesterday. Here's President Trump sitting next to Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy in the Oval Office.
Now, under the new rules being issued today by Secretary Duffy, the Department of Transportation will rescind the Biden fuel economy prices. And I hate to say that because they were really not economy. They were really, anti-economy.
These rules require automakers to make new cars more efficient every year or face fines. The proposed new rules would reset standards to where they were in 2022, and then instead of requiring 2% improvements in efficiency each year, they'd require just 0.5%. Environmental and public health groups have called this a step backward for human health and the environment. President Trump framed it as a win for affordability. He argues that the technology needed to make cars more efficient drives up prices.
They were horrible what they were doing to the costs and actually making the car much worse.
Different types of clean car technology can cost more upfront, but economic analyses have found that's outweighed by how much drivers save on gasoline. This is still a proposal, now in the public comment phase. Once finalized, this policy shift is likely to boost the bottom lines of automakers who could sell as many big pickups as they like without worrying about penalties. Although actually, the Trump administration already eased that worry. This summer, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act erased all the penalties for companies that fell short of these fuel economy standards. So in that sense, the rules were already irrelevant. So why change them? Well, the Trump administration is trying multiple tactics to make sure the policy changes stick even after a change in presidents, anticipating another twist of the roller coaster. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Listener-supported KQED 719 Morning Drive with Mel Baker, taking a look at the commute around the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge right now.
where the commute is crawling from about Cutting Boulevard to the toll plaza, very slow going. As you get to the west end, the San Quentin off-ramp from westbound 580 is still blocked by a crash there involving a semi. On the Bay Bridge, the backup is to the Maze. Westbound 80 is slow from Golden Gate Fields to the Maze. It is, of course, slow across the upper deck into San Francisco. And San Jose, 280 northbound after McLaughlin Road, the second lane from the left, blocked by a two-vehicle crash. It's backed up to 680. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Left-Handed Girl, Taiwan's official submission for international feature at the Academy Awards. A Fresh Beginning in Taipei comes with Generations of Secrets. Now on Netflix. Awards eligible. The Cal Privacy, from enforcing privacy laws to educating Californians on how to exercise their privacy rights. Cal Privacy is working hard to make privacy easy. Learn more at privacy.ca.gov. Morning Edition continues next. Coming up, federal law enforcement sources believe they have solved a long-standing mystery. Who placed pipe bombs near the Capitol hours before the siege on January 6, 2021? The details ahead.
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum at 10 a.m., the clock is ticking on healthcare. Federal subsidies expire at the end of the month, and 22 million Americans could see their insurance premiums double. Senate Republicans want to redirect funds into health savings accounts or dismantle the marketplace entirely, while Democrats push to extend the tax credits. We'll look at the proposals and how the healthcare vote could shape the 2026 midterms. That's Forum at 10 a.m. on KQED.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. And the listeners of KQED. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. Morning Edition continues as the time approaches 7:22.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Federal law enforcement officials believe they have solved a years-long mystery. Who placed pipe bombs near the U.S. Capitol hours before the mob attack on January 6, 2021? As of this morning, the FBI has taken a man into custody in connection with those bombs. NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is here with more details. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning.
So what more can you tell us?
A federal law enforcement source told me there is a man in custody. He's believed to be responsible for putting those pipe bombs near the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee buildings nearly 5 years ago. There's a news conference planned for later today in Washington to unveil new details and possible charges. We should say this is a major development in a case that's frustrated investigators for years now. FBI officials said they believe these bombs could have worked even though they did not detonate, so there was a real public safety issue here in their minds.
You mentioned how frustrated investigators have been until now, and I would also mention members of the public who wonder, you know, what happened here. So what kind of digging did they do?
Earlier this year, the FBI told me they interviewed 1,000 people over the course of this investigation, reviewed nearly 40,000 video files, pursued 600 tips. They spent time looking for purchases of a specific and unusual kind of shoe, a Nike Air Max shoe that the alleged bomber wore. They also analyzed location data from cell phones in the area near Capitol Hill. And the FBI actually announced a $500,000 reward around the anniversary of the event in January this year. New leaders at the FBI and the Justice Department made the case a priority, too. There was really a lot of political pressure from President Trump's MAGA base on getting answers here.
So what comes next in this case?
We're awaiting more details and information about possible criminal charges against the suspect, and we're really looking for more answers about whether these pipe bombs were connected at all to the riot at the Capitol that happened only hours later. There'd been some working theories that the bombs were placed to divert police attention from that mob swarming the Capitol building on January 6th. So I'm going to be listening for more information about that. And nearly 5 years seems like a long time for this kind of mystery to endure. But other notorious bombing cases have taken even longer to solve. There's Eric Rudolph, who planted a bomb at the Atlanta Olympic site in 1996. He eluded investigators until his capture in 2003. And then the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, sowed fear for nearly two decades until his brother recognized some of his writings and alerted authorities.
That is NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you.
Thank you.
What do American veterans think of Trump administration moves against Afghan refugees? The president responded last week after one Afghan national allegedly shot two National Guard members in Washington, D.C. Trump froze the process under which thousands of Afghans were granted asylum. Many of them had risked their lives to work with the United States, which is why some veterans now feel their allies are being abandoned. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
When Thomas Kaza deployed to Afghanistan in 2019 with the Green Berets, he served with a special unit of Afghans clearing IEDs and landmines.
The Afghans laid down their lives as pretty much four times the rate as a Green Beret did. So that's an incredible level of sacrifice that was undertaken by those guys.
After the Taliban captured Kabul in 2021, Kaza was one of the U.S. veterans who scrambled to help Afghan comrades escape. His group, the 1208 Foundation, is trying to rescue roughly 1,000 Afghans still living under Taliban rule whose family members fought alongside U.S. Special Forces.
For the guys who are detected, the risk is catastrophically higher.
Under the Biden administration, tens of thousands of Afghan allies and their families were vetted and allowed into the U.S. But last week, one of those men, 29-year-old Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, who worked with the CIA, allegedly opened fire on two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C., leaving one dead, the other seriously wounded. Lakhanwal pleaded not guilty to murder and other charges. Hours after the attack, President Trump condemned the Afghan refugee effort.
We must now re-examine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden.
The attack in D.C., followed by Trump's freeze on asylum claims, were devastating for Afghans like M, who worked for the U.S. Defense Department in Kabul before fleeing to the U.S.
Everyone is scared. It's so sad. It's scary.
M agreed to speak with NPR if we only identified her by an initial. She fears the U.S. government could strip her legal status. She also fears for the safety of family members still in Afghanistan. M says Afghans who worked with the U.S. left behind under the Taliban are in grave danger.
Everyone who are associated or work for the U.S., themselves plus their family are in trouble.
NPR heard over and over that delays in the Afghan refugee process could be deadly for U.S. allies. Mohammed worked as an interpreter for the U.S. military in Kabul and now helps organize asylum efforts.
We lost one person that he were arrested by the Taliban and beaten to the death. He died. He lost his life. And we have his family that we're working on their paperwork to bring them over here.
Mohammed, too, agreed to be interviewed only if NPR concealed his full name because he fears for the safety of family members still in Afghanistan. Mohammed said if the U.S. leaves behind Afghans who served alongside American soldiers, it would send a grim message.
All the world will identify United States Army like a fair weather friend. They just use them, and after that, if their work is done, so they just abandon them.
NPR reached out to the Defense Department to ask how Trump's freeze on asylum claims for America's Afghan allies might affect operations in future conflicts. A spokesman declined to comment. But U.S. military veterans leading the Afghan refugee effort say the policy could dissuade future allies. Sean Vandiver is a U.S. Navy veteran with the group Afghan Evac.
They're going to point out what has happened with our Afghan allies and say, hell no, we're not going to help you. Look what you did.
Thomas Kaza, the former Green Beret, says he too thinks this policy could haunt the U.S.
Those future U.S. partners are going to know what is happening today. Everybody who partners with us is going to ask, hey, what happens when the Americans leave? And they're going to point to this.
Kaza says he still hopes to convince the Trump administration that America's Afghan allies paid a heavy price, earning a chance at life in the U.S. Brian Mann, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And it's KQED News. In a minute after KQED traffic, as Mel takes us to San Lorenzo.
Where a southbound 880 is sluggish from I-238 down to Fremont Boulevard, westbound on the San Mateo Bridge, traffic is pretty much backed up to from 880 to the Toll Plaza and then slow across the span to the west end. On the San Mateo Bridge, it's slow from the tolls to the west end. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Mark Feringer's Nutcracker Suites at the Cal Theater, a magical 50-minute dance storytelling with live music for children of all ages, December 6th through 21st in San Francisco. Tickets at fortmason.org. And Silicon Valley Community Foundation, raising urgent funds needed to support local nonprofits as low-income residents' access to food, shelter, health care, and other essential services is at risk. Learn more at svcf.org. Listener-supported KQED. Good morning. I'm Dave Freeman. And the time now, 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Teachers in the West Contra Costa Unified School District are launching an open-ended strike today. That's after months of unsuccessful contract talks. Families of some of the district's 28,000 students are joining educators on the picket lines, as we hear from KQED's Sarah Hosseini.
Since last Friday, when bargaining officially reached an impasse, parents like Nora Ponce have been scrambling to form childcare pods and carpool groups. They're working to help take care of each other's kids and of teachers on the picket lines.
We're going to take them outdoors. We are going to be of service to our community and our teachers, and we will get it done for as long as it takes.
Ponce's son attends a dual Spanish immersion elementary in Richmond, where she says large class sizes and teacher attrition have taken a toll. First grade teacher Gabrielle Micheletti says it's the kids who suffer most.
First grade is all about teaching to read, and sometimes I would have students with pretty profound speech challenges they needed worked on, and some sites that just didn't have specialists for months to years, or they'll have substitutes coming in.
The union is asking for what it calls a competitive wage, a 5% raise over each of 2 years. The school district has offered one 3% bump and says a strike may only deepen its current financial woes. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
A 30-day jail sentence for the UC Berkeley student and animal activist convicted of trespassing onto a farm and stealing chickens is set to begin next week, KQED's Dana Cronin reports.
At the sentencing hearing for Zoe Rosenberg on Wednesday afternoon, the judge issued a 90-day hybrid sentence, including 60 days of jail alternatives. She'll also serve 2 years of supervised probation and is forbidden from going near Petaluma Poultry, the farm she broke into in 2023. Rosenberg spoke to hundreds of supporters outside the courthouse before the hearing.
My actions have obviously had consequences for me personally. But it is also true that if I had not acted, 4 little lives wouldn't have been saved.
The Sonoma County District Attorney's Office had asked for a 180-day sentence due to what it called a, quote, staggering lack of remorse. Rosenberg is set to report to custody on December 10th. I'm Dana Cronin, KQED News.
San Francisco officials say a pilot program that loosened vehicle restrictions on Market Street to allow robo-taxis and ride-hail vehicles is moving forward. Currently, the city is allowing Waymo, Lyft, and Uber to use some loading bays. The pilot's next phase, later this month, will lift limits on the hours and on the number of vehicles they can operate. Transit and pedestrian advocacy groups say it's a move in the wrong direction. Christopher White with the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition.
We have consistently heard about and witnessed more private vehicles illegally driving on Market Street since the experiment began. And who can blame them when, to all appearances, Market Street is back open to cars?
Business groups support the move, which they hope will help revitalize the downtown area. Sports, the Sharks lost to the Capitals, kind of big, 7-1. The Warriors play the Sixers in Philly for our time. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Thursday's support comes from Postman, used by 40 million developers to build APIs that help AI make smarter decisions. More at postman.com.
Coming up, Steve Inskeep speaks with epidemiologist Michael Osterholm about Thursday's Federal Vaccine Advisory Committee meeting and proposed changes to the child vaccination schedule. Support for NPR comes from Bayer. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at AU.org. And by the listeners and sustaining members of KQED. Some morning sunshine, a bit of fog. Look for highs today, 50s to the mid-60s around the Bay Area.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Vaccine advisors for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention meet today and tomorrow, and they're expected to question how pediatricians vaccinate children for more than a dozen diseases.
NPR Health correspondent Ping Huan is with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
What's this meeting about?
So this is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This is a panel that's been making recommendations on how vaccines should be used since 1964. And back in June, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed all the previous members, and he replaced them with members who have shown that they are not, generally speaking, all that familiar with the details of vaccine policy or how this group shapes it. At their last meeting in October, the committee's chairman said that they were rookies when they had to redo a vote. That chairman was replaced just this week, and the new chair is Dr. Kirk Milhone. He's a pediatric cardiologist and a fellow with the Independent Medical Alliance, which is a group that still recommends people use drugs like ivermectin to treat COVID, even though studies have shown it does not work.
So what will be covered in this meeting?
So a few things. First of all, the group is going to be voting on whether to drop the recommendation that hepatitis B vaccines be given to babies at birth. This is a policy that's been in effect for more than 30 years. And it's something that came up at the last meeting, where some members wanted to push the vaccine back to when kids are older, and others said it would be a mistake. Now, since that meeting, independent researchers have found that delaying the Hep B vaccine by even a couple of months could lead to hundreds of preventable deaths each year. That's from liver cancers and health problems that are prevented by getting this $15 vaccine. Also, they're going to be discussing the overall vaccine schedule, which is who gets which vaccines and when, and also what goes into vaccines.
What are their concerns about the vaccine schedule?
So Milhone, the new committee chair, told the Washington Post that they're going to be looking into whether vaccines are causing asthma, eczema, and other autoimmune diseases in children. This is even though large long-term studies have found no evidence for this. Dr. Sean O'Leary with the American Academy of Pediatrics says that every vaccine on the schedule is vetted.
And it's based on the age at which a child's immune system can provide optimal protection after vaccination, balanced with the age the child is at highest risk for a disease.
Now, Kennedy has also enraged the public health community recently by ordering changes to the CDC's website, suggesting that vaccines, and specifically an ingredient containing aluminum, might cause autism. This is also not supported by scientific consensus, but it's also a topic for this meeting.
And just for folks who might be interested, why is aluminum in vaccines?
Yeah, so it's not the aluminum metal by itself. These are chemicals that contain aluminum, and they're used to boost the immune system to make the vaccine more effective. Now, they've been used in vaccines since the 1930s, and they're currently used in more than a dozen of them in very small amounts. But if these ingredients get banned, as some advocates have pushed for, there are no substitute vaccines without them that are ready to go. It could take years for replacements to be developed and to be made.
So there is a lot at stake in this meeting.
There is, yeah, and a lot of people in medicine, public health are going to be watching very closely. And while doctors' groups and some state health departments are making their own independent vaccine recommendations now, this panel still influences what insurance covers, and with these public meetings, they have a big megaphone to shape what people hear and think about vaccines.
That's NPR health correspondent Ping Huang. Ping, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next guest is an epidemiologist. Michael Osterholm directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How important is this vote on delaying hepatitis B vaccines?
Well, Steve, I can tell you without any doubt in my 50 years in the business that this is probably the most defining moment for our country in public health. If they, in fact, vote down the hepatitis B recommendation today, where the science is clear and compelling and children's lives are at risk, this will mean we can no longer trust federal health authorities when it comes to vaccines, which has, as you know, been the actual standard bearer of vaccine science for all of these years. So this is a huge issue today.
Wow, a lot to follow up on there. First, why would delaying the hepatitis B vaccine by just a couple of months, but still giving the vaccine, make such a difference in its effectiveness? It doesn't sound like that big a deal.
Well, actually, it's a very big deal because the number one way in which the kids are infected with hepatitis B virus is actually exposure to blood during the birthing process to an infected mom.
Hmm.
And so the virus transmits at that point. If you can vaccinate literally at the time of delivery or shortly thereafter, as well as give a type of immune globulin we call HBIG, it's an antibody that will help also tie up the virus, you can actually prevent that transmission from occurring. So it's too late to wait months later to vaccinate the child. This is not about them getting exposed, you know, through sex and drugs, as has often been referred to as the reason why you don't need to vaccinate young kids. It's that transmission from an infected mom.
You also said that if they take this vote, if they make this move in defiance of the science, that we can no longer trust HHS. We can no longer trust this committee. I had an opportunity to hear Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a speech last month in Arizona. And in this speech, he accused people at his own agency of malpractice. He said, quote, they haven't been doing their job. He claims to represent people who don't trust the health agencies, and they're doing something about it. It seems to me that you are now flipping that around, and you're saying actually what the agency is doing now is what is endangering trust. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it's uniform across the world in terms of their response to what's happening. In fact, just yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine, 12 former FDA commissioners from both Republican and Democratic administrations wrote a scathing article about what's happening right now at HHS and the whole challenge that has come to the advisory committee immunization practices. Countries across the world are also in the same position. And finally, let me just say, all of the various medical societies, whether it's the American Academy of Pediatrics, American College of Obstetricians, Gynecologists, Infectious Disease Society of America, all are on the same side here. I've never seen a more unified public health situation than I do now. The one challenge, of course, is our own federal government is spreading mis- and disinformation that is causing parents not to vaccinate their children.
And we should note the government has already taken a large number of actions. We don't know how this committee is going to vote today, but suppose they take this vote, which for you is momentous and a Rubicon, and it means we can no longer trust the agency at all. If that happens, where would you have me turn for reliable information on vaccines for myself or my family?
I think at this point it's going to be the medical societies. And we did accomplish that very issue last fall when our group at the Vaccine Integrity Project at the University of Minnesota actually put together a body of detailed information on updating the COVID vaccines, the flu vaccines, and the RSV vaccines. And at that point, this medical society signed on, and we did come up with different recommendations that have been used.
Can go to those recommendations or go to our individual doctors, I suppose.
Exactly. That's where the most important information needs to be, is with the doctors to be able to share with their patients.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Mel takes a look at your drive in San Jose next on KQED Traffic.
Northbound 101 before Hellier Avenue remains blocked. A truck carrying gravel had overturned earlier. It spilled the gravel across the roadway. There are a few vehicles sneaking by on the center divide, but basically traffic is completely backed up through there. Use Monterey Road and Bailey Road as your Bailey Avenue, I should say, as your alternates. San Jose also, 280 northbound after McLaughlin Road, an accident there now on the shoulder, but it's left traffic backed up between 880 and 101. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Xfinity, delivering smart Wi-Fi, mobile, home security, and entertainment to help power a seamlessly connected life. Learn more at Xfinity.com. Xfinity, imagine that. On Morning Edition coming up, the New York Times sued Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth yesterday over the Pentagon's new policy that requires media outlets to pledge not to gather information unless officials authorize its release. The story ahead.
This week on Bay Curious.
I'm Gabriella Glick. The Nimitz House is this grand-looking house tucked underneath the Bay Bridge's eastern span. I ended up talking to someone who lived there, and it turns out that the Nimitz House is kind of a vestige of Yerba Buena Island's military history. It was the house for the top commanding officer on base, and the house has fallen into a bit of disrepair.
Listen to the new episode now, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Tong. The Trump administration has raised the idea of a 50-year mortgage. Could mean lower monthly payments, but the interest would really pile up.
Most people move, or they refinance, or they pay it off early. So most people aren't paying the interest over the 30 years, and they probably wouldn't over the 50 years either.
Next time, Here and Now.
50 years of interest? Hear more on Here and Now, 11 to 1 today on KQED News.
We hear the word ideology a lot these days from both conservatives and liberals. How the meaning of the word has changed on All Things Considered from NPR News.
1 o'clock today. Support for NPR comes from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more. MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the generous listeners, members, sustaining members of KQED. On Thursday, I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning, now 7:46.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The New York Times is suing the Pentagon and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over the Pentagon's new media policy. The newspaper says the policy violates its constitutional rights and restricts press access in an effort to deprive the public of an independent understanding of military matters. NPR media correspondent David Folgenflik is here in the studio, actually, to tell us more about this. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us more about the lawsuit. What's in it?
So this stems back from a policy that was put in place in September from the defense secretary on down, and it says that reporters credentialed to report from inside the Pentagon can only seek and report out information that the Pentagon's leadership has formally approved for public release. And let's be really clear about this. This policy even forbids reporting and gathering unclassified information that the Pentagon brass hasn't permitted. New York Times says this is a violation of their First Amendment right, that is free speech and freedom of the press. The New York Times also alleges this is a violation of constitutional protections for due process. That's, you know, the fact that this decision appeared to be plucked out of the air and there's no real process to appeal. We, of course, have reached out to the Pentagon for comment about this lawsuit.
So the policy isn't the only way that this administration has tried to limit news organizations covering the Defense Department. Say more about that, if you would. What's the pattern here?
So let's not forget, Pete Hegseth was a former star at Fox News. He was the co-host of the weekend show Fox and Friends, and that is really, although he's a former military veteran, that is really how he came to the president's attention. He's basically given the established press the Heisman. He has preferred to communicate through memes rather than press conferences or interviews with folks who try to provide an independent check on what the military does. They earlier in the year implemented restrictions on mobility for reporters around the buildings, implying somehow that people were skulking about to all corners and crevices of the five-cornered building known as the Pentagon. That's not really the case. They were fairly limited anyway, but it limited interaction between people who weren't at the top levels with regular reporters. And it's also part of a larger pattern, as you guys know, right? The Trump administration limited the Associated Press in ways that they had been able to do things previously. Trump is, as a private citizen, you know, sued ABC's parent company. He sued CBS's parent company, got significant payouts from them to settle those mm-hmm. lawsuits. The FCC's chairman under Trump has initiated essentially informal investigations of every broadcast network that the president has criticized, including our own. It's really all of a piece.
So just going back to the Pentagon now, basically the administration just wants the media organizations to be an extension of their press office. They basically want them to be their publicists, basically. So most news organizations, I'd say major legacy news organizations, including The Times and NPR, have refused to agree to this policy. Their credentials were revoked, or they turned them in. Have you seen it affect coverage of the Pentagon yet?
I think you're still seeing a lot of mainstream news organizations break stories, much to the consternation of folks at the Pentagon. You know, if you think back over just this year, the first year of the second Trump term, news organizations have broken major story contradicting the official line. Think of strikes on the Iranian nuclear sites. Think of more recently the strikes on Venezuelan boats. Most recently, Inspector General came out with a conclusion that the Pentagon Secretary Hegseth could have endangered American troops' lives by engaging in an unsafe signal chat that was broken by the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. And what you're also seeing is, you know, the effort to do that outside the Pentagon while sycophants are being brought in, conspiracy theorists and pro-MAGA online influencers. It's a very different press corps right now.
That is NPR's David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Time for another look at your drive around the bay with Mel starting in Burlingame.
101 southbound before Broadway, the second lane from the left, blocked by an SUV and car crash. It is stacked up to Millbrae Avenue. 101 northbound heading into San Francisco, 3rd Street up to the hospital curve. That's quite sluggish right now. 280 northbound is backing up towards San Jose Avenue. Mel Baker for KQED.
Marketplace Morning Report ahead on KQED News at 7:51. Planning on traveling without a real ID? Get the latest on TSA plans to impose a fee on those without an acceptable form of ID. Also ahead, would you make a phone call on the moon? Hear from a company that is figuring out how people and machines might communicate on the moon. All of that and much more in a little over a minute.
China makes almost three-quarters of the world's electric vehicles. The megacity of Shenzhen is at the center of that EV dominance.
The buses in Shenzhen have been completely electric since 2017. Uh-huh. The taxis have been completely electric since 2018. And now 85% of new vehicles sold here are fully electric.
A Chinese city at the cutting edge of electric cars, next time on The World.
Check it out today on KQED News at 2. Pete has been hiding out in Adelaide for a year, suspended, isolated, and off the radar. But in the episode Civ and Sort, a sudden emergency pulls him back into the action, throwing him into high-stakes decisions and old tensions with the RFDS team. Don't miss the new season of RFDS, Royal Flying Doctor Service, tonight at 8 p.m. on KQED+. KQED News, Thursday morning, 7:51.
Might we soon look up into the night sky to see a crescent or disc-shaped economy?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, the front of your ID card, including driver's license, does it have the little star shape indicating it is a real ID? More today on TSA airport security people announcing that that folks with an ID but without real ID will soon have to pay a $45 fee to travel. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
Most current driver's licenses are real IDs, which meet higher federal security standards.
There have been 17 years for people to get compliant with Real ID.
Janice Kephart is CEO of identity compliance firm Zip ID and consulted on the 9/11 commission that spawned the stricter identity requirements.
It's only about 6% of people might not be presenting a Real ID or a biometric equivalent at this point. So it's a pretty small percentage.
And who are those folks? Mostly people who don't travel much by air, says Ifeanyi Davis of Louisiana Appleseed Center for Law and Justice.
This can also be really difficult or challenging for people who have missing birth records, for people who are dealing with the legality around their name change.
Critics of the new fee say most people will probably just pay to finally get their real IDs rather than deal with the hassle, which is kind of the point, says the TSA's Steve Lorenz.
For us, the big push is security. The big push is compliance. The big push is for people to get their real ID.
But if they don't, starting February 1st, they'll either need to pay the fee online in advance or expect to spend even more time going through security at the airport. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This $45 fee will be good for 10 days of travel, so for trips longer than that, passengers with ID but not real ID would pay again. Passports are among a short list of documents that will still work at airport security without the fee. This is all, again, come February. Markets, the Dow is down 8 points. The S&P is up just slightly 3 points. The NASDAQ is up 0.1%. The bond market is down, pushing the 10-year Treasury yield up to 4.1%. Companies announced plans to lay off a total of 71,000 people in November. That makes the last 11 months the worst such period for layoff announcements since 2020, which you will remember was the horrible first pandemic year. This according to the firm Challenger Gray and Christmas, which tracks these.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
As you gaze up at this evening's supermoon, up to 14% larger seeming and 30% brighter, don't get greedy. To quote Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, outer space, including the moon, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means. So you can't do a land grab up there, but you can conduct business on the moon. This week, multiple views here on an emerging moon economy, how it might work, and if it's even a good idea. Christina Guidi is Assistant General Manager for Space Technology and Transportation at a nonprofit entity called the Aerospace Corporation. Among the many projects, it coordinates how people and machines might communicate with each other on the moon.
What we are doing in partnership with NASA for their Artemis missions is creating LunaNet, which is essentially a communications and navigation architecture or system that allows us to communicate to rovers, as you mentioned, also to orbiting spacecraft and astronauts on the surface of the moon from Earth and to each other while they're on the lunar surface.
What about knowing where you are on the moon? I think some of my listeners will be ahead of me on this, right? But the GPS system that we use for our maps to work on our phone involve satellites around Earth. It's probably not going to help you if you're on the moon.
That's what this LunaNet is going to help do, is actually provide that situational awareness of where you are, your position, and allow for navigation of the different assets and astronauts as well. So it's a critical infrastructure that we need to put in place for Artemis to be sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure would include, I don't know, structures, building on the moon. It's a lot cheaper if you can build with stuff that's actually already on the moon, and what that mainly is that lunar dirt. I guess there's promise there of turning that into usable stuff.
That's a key area. In situ resource utilization includes using the lunar regolith to construct structures, to convert the lunar regolith into water and air. There's a lot on the lunar surface that we could actually exploit, but you also have to think about, we have to have power, right? Where are we going to get our power from? We need robotic or mobility devices that would actually push the regolith around to create a landing pad.
I mean, on the side facing the sun, you can use solar, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we're also looking at fission nuclear power sources. So we've got several companies actually developing systems that can actually be deployed on the lunar surface just for that reason, so that it can actually operate during the lunar night.
Chris, I got a favor, though. When you're in meetings coordinating a lunar economy to come, can you tell them not to make a mess? I mean, there are environmental concerns.
Oh, absolutely. But one thing we need to consider looking forward is, how do we take the leftover materials or hardware and reuse it? So that would be a technology that needs to be developed across the community to repurpose material that is not used completely. That's something that needs to be considered in the future for sure.
Christina Guidi is Assistant General Manager for the Space Technology and Transportation Subdivision in the Human Exploration and Space Flight Division at Aerospace Corporation. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a professor of religion and science studies about more of these ethical and environmental issues if the moon were to be developed. Our interviews are accumulating at marketplace.org. We also have a new video where I show what I've learned about the stock market by building and launching big amateur rockets. Search Marketplace APM on TikTok, Facebook, or Instagram for the video. It's Marketplace Morning Report from APM. American Public Media.
Another hour of Morning Edition, KQED News, and the California Report will lift off in under a minute after Mel does a Bay Area traffic update for us.
In Rohnert Park, 101 northbound between Golf Course Drive and College Avenue, it is slow. Slow southbound from Windsor between Shiloh Road and Hopper Avenue, and then again from College Avenue down to Baker. In Novato, it's much denser traffic, 101 southbound between Roland Boulevard and North San Pedro Road. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from San Francisco's MetaFund, advancing health and equity in aging, and reminding listeners that elders add value to communities every day. Learn more at mettafund.org. You're on member-supported KQED, 88.5 San Francisco, KQEI, 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento.